Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to The Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and it's Happily Ever After, the show that takes a closer look at the fairy tales that we fell in love with once upon a time. Now, fairy tales in general use really simple ingredients to tell an uncomplicated story. It starts with once upon a time, there's a hero and a villain, and between them there's a fight against good and evil, and then at the end there's a happily ever after. And this formula sort of makes them these perfect stories to retell and revisit time and time again. But then you get some storytellers who will take these same ingredients and use them to create something that's a little bit different.
Hey, by the way, this is a fairy tale. It's going to look like a war film in about 10 minutes, but, you know, you need to know this is a fairy tale. So we could look at it that way.
That's Mike Pershawn. He teaches English at McEwan University in Canada, and he specializes in comparative literature with a focus on science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And the film that Mike is referring to is called Pan's Labyrinth. Some of you may know it. It's a 2006 Spanish film by Guillermo del Toro. And although Disney fairy tale films are still pretty fun to watch, what makes Pan Labyrinth great is that it takes these bits and pieces of what you would typically find in a fairy tale and refashion it into this entirely new, much darker fairy tale that's actually meant for adults. And I'm speaking to Mike because, apart from the guys who actually made the film, Mike is probably the one person who's seen Pan's Labyrinth the most. It was the subject of his master's thesis, and he's now teaching it in his courses. So he's familiar with almost every nook and cranny of the film.
If I can find a way to teach Pan's Labyrinth, I will stick it into a course because I just think it's that great a film. I watched it in a number of different ways. So I would watch it with the sound off. I would watch it with the subtitles off. I watched it on high speed. I watched it with the commentary track on. Just looking for different things because so often we watch film like it's talking heads. And people focus on things like dialogue an awful lot in film, but film's a visual medium. Guillermo del Toro is a very visual director. He really understands cinema. And so it works really well not only as an instance of fairy tale cinema, but it's also a really great instance of really well-made film.
If you haven't seen the film, that's okay. Here's what you need to know. The movie takes place in Spain in 1944, 5 years after the end of the Spanish Civil War.
It's a hybrid film.
Which in this case means that it's sort of set in two worlds.
That is both a historical film about the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, and it's also about this little girl who ends up in the woods living with her wicked stepfather instead of a wicked stepmother.
And the little girl in question is Ophelia. She's 12 years old, and the story begins with her traveling with her pregnant and frail mother, Carmen, to meet her new stepfather. Ophelia's stepfather's name is Captain Vidal, and like Mike says, Vidal is the wicked stepfather. He's the bad guy in this story.
And she goes on these quests, or a single quest, I guess, to find three different objects. And she's sent on this quest by a magical being, a fawn.
So the fawn is a creature that looks like this cross between a goat and a tree. And he's pretty creepy looking, and you're never quite sure if he's evil or good. But in some ways, he's kind of like Ophelia's fairy godmother.
And the movie plays back and forth, cross-cutting between that historical storyline and that fairy tale storyline.
So if we were to think of this in fairy tale terms, we could say that Ophelia is the princess, Vidal is the evil stepfather, and the fawn is the fairy godmother. And there are fairies and other mythical creatures, and there's of course plenty of magic. But it also has something that we wouldn't usually associate with fairy tales.
So we normally associate fairy tales with Disney, or, you know, with children's literature. And here's this film that's rated R, and deservedly so. It's a very mature work, and yet it's still, at its center, has this little girl.
So you were saying that Pan's Labyrinth ticks all the boxes of what would feature in a fairy tale. What are some of those things that is prominent in Pan's Labyrinth that does sort of signal to the audience that, yes, this is a fairy tale?
Good conquers evil is a standard trope of fairy tales. Even in the old dark ones, sometimes, you know, you'd get, like in Cinderella, the wicked stepsisters being punished in really grotesque ways. So people get what's coming to them in fairy tales. And Pan's Labyrinth checks off that box perfectly, because Vidal is judged at the end of the film, and he's not just killed, he's erased. He's told no one will ever, your son's not even going to know you ever existed. So there's that, the sort of good conquers evil. There's the idea that the hero wins. And in this case, somebody would say, well, Ophelia doesn't win, she dies. Sorry for the spoiler for those who haven't seen it.
So Ophelia's death is kind of the first scene of the movie, so it's not really a spoiler. What we don't really know is who killed Ophelia, but Mike does talk about it later on. So I guess, yeah, there are going to be some spoilers throughout the show.
She does win. She does triumph. And the film, you know, leaves it questionable as to whether or not, you know, is she really experiencing the reward at the end or not. But there is a sense that, insofar as she's concerned, it's a reality, and that's good enough. And so you have that repetition of the idea of the hero winning. There's a strong repetition in old fairy tales of gender and sexuality, and not in a reduced sort of pornographic or erotica sense, but in the idea of what makes us who we are in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality. And Pan's Labyrinth does that by capturing Ophelia at this transitional age where she is moving from childhood into becoming a woman. And she has these role models in her mother, who is very much a sleeping beauty. She's not an active participant in her life. And then you've got Mercedes.
Mercedes is Vidal's housekeeper, but she's secretly working with the rebels, who the evil Vidal is trying to defeat. Mercedes is brave, and to Ophelia, she becomes this really strong motherly figure, especially when Carmen, Ophelia's mother, becomes more and more sick throughout the film.
It's interesting that the actresses for Carmen and Mercedes resemble each other so strongly. I think Del Toro meant to double them somewhat. It's almost like he's offering Ophelia these two trajectories. You can either be this woman who does whatever the man tells her to and gets pregnant because he wants her to and needs somebody, or you can be this other woman, Mercedes, who has chosen a life of resistance, and she's given up all the things that Carmen gets to do it. And then at the same time, Ophelia never gets to walk down either of those paths because her life is cut short. So it deals with the elements of gender and sexuality strongly, even just the level of plot. But then you get these moments. Like, I remember the first time I realized that the tree that she crawls into looks like a woman's reproductive organs, looks like fallopian tubes. It looks like she's literally crawling back into the womb. And she's going down there to deal with a monster that's eating away at this tree that looks like reproductive organs while her mother is dying because of a complicated pregnancy. So, you know, it's nuts.
It is. And is it supposed to in any way reflect what kids are experiencing at that age? Is that...
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because Ophelia says, you know, if this is what happens, then I don't ever want to have kids. She asks Mercedes all sorts of questions. When you were a child, did you this, that, or the other thing? And so there is those moments of becoming the next thing you're going to be. You're not a child anymore. You're moving into this new state. And then I think the other thing that's great about the use of a child, which is a sense of wonder or magic, is repeated in fairy tales and fairy tale films. And children can see what adults can't. So Jack's mother in Jack and the Beanstalk berates him for being so stupid as to sell their cow for a handful of beans. But Jack, somehow in his childish wisdom, sees that this is the best thing possible. And Ophelia is the only one who can see the fawn. We even get scenes where, you know, she's standing talking to the fawn. We see the fawn with her, And then we see it from an adult's perspective, like Vidal's, and he can't see the fawn. And it becomes this moment of questioning where the audience wonders, is this all made up in her head, or is it just that he can't see the magic, or what's going on here, right? But that sense of being young enough to still believe in things like magic is important as well.
Like you said, so many people associate fairy tales with Disney, with, you know, Cinderella and all those very sweet stories that you grew up taking in. But if you look at something like Pan's Labyrinth, it actually has a lot in common with the original fairy tales that existed, yes, from way back. And is that what Guillermo was trying to do? Was he trying to make an old school fairy tale?
Yeah, he definitely was. In the interviews that he's given about the film, it's like watching, I felt like I was watching a classmate talking about the same things that I had been learning in classes that I'd taken on folklore and fairy tales, or on, you know, the fairy tales of Hans Christian Andersen. And so I would be listening to him, and he kept talking about the same things that I was reading. So he's definitely working off of that fairy tale, that early fairy tale tradition. But then he's also bringing his own, especially political view to the film. And that's another place where it drastically changes it, because even when fairy tales were violent and dark, there was a, here's the lesson you need to learn from my little tale. And Del Toro, he's giving a lesson, but he's not forcing it down our throats. The very structure of the film refuses to be the thing that he hates most, which is fascism. He's like, Del Toro just hates fascism. He grew up under it, and his movies from Pan's Labyrinth to Pacific Rim, they all feature characters who say, no, I'm not going to do what you say.
There's a huge amount of disobedience that you talk about.
Well, that's Ophelia over and over again. The line she says most frequently is no, right? She shakes Captain Vidal's hand with the wrong hand. She says no, not only to the person we expect her to, like we sort of expect the fairy tale child to transgress. Like Jack and the Beanstalk, the kid is doing a breaking and entering. But we think, you know, that's okay because he's going up against the monster. And so when Ophelia says no to Vidal, we're like, yeah, you're saying no to the monster. But she says no to the fawn at certain points and at very crucial points. And that's the thing that makes her the hero of this story, because in Del Toro's imagination, saying no to someone who says, you must obey me, is the best thing you could possibly do.
Like we've mentioned before, another huge part of what differentiates Pan's Labyrinth as a fairy tale film is the amount of violence that's in it. So we'll be taking a closer look at that when we come back. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
You're back on Happily Ever After here on the Evening Edition, where I've been speaking to Mike Pershon, who teaches English at McEwen University in Canada. And in tonight's episode, we've been taking a look at a fairy tale film called Pan's Labyrinth, which is sort of whirls away from the sanitized Disney fairy tales that we've become accustomed to. Now, there's a lot of things that make Pan's Labyrinth so different. First of all, it's in Spanish. But I think the clearest difference is that it can be extremely graphic and violent. And at the root of that violence is Captain Vidal, who is the stepfather and the evil character in this fairy tale.
He's all sorts of fairy tale characters. Like I said, the wicked stepfather, you've got that terrible parent in a lot of fairy tales, and Vidal fills that role perfectly. But he's also very much a big bad wolf in that in a lot of the Red Riding Hood stories, you have this wolf who's very charming, and Red Riding Hood can't see the wolf for what it is until, you know, in some versions it's too late. And Vidal is, from an exterior point of view, very charming. He's very put together. He's, you know, military precision. He buffs his boots in the morning. He makes sure he's clean shaven. His hair is pristine. And yet, as the film goes on, he becomes more and more unkempt. His monstrosity becomes more exterior. It becomes revealed. And so by the end of the film, he's got his face slashed open, and he's got a bullet wound, and he's a mess. And his monstrosity becomes revealed to us.
So there's a scene early in the film that sets the tone really fast about what kind of monster Vidal is. In this scene, Vidal suspects that a man and his father are rebels. So he takes a bottle, and in front of this guy's father, he starts smashing this poor man's face in. Over and over again. It's brutal and it's uncomfortable to watch.
And the really bizarre thing is that the actor who played Vidal was mostly known for comedy. And so, yeah, and so you can imagine an audience's reaction to this person who they were used to making them laugh, smashing somebody's face in with a bottle. That scene, more than any other, is the one that just turns people's stomachs. I warn my students right before they have to see it. I say, this is one of those scenes. I tell them at the beginning, you don't have to watch this whole movie. I will warn you, because it is such a monstrous moment. But then it gets balanced out, but only a little bit, by this sub-story where we find out that Vidal's father smashed this watch on the field of battle and passed it along to his son. And there's sort of a moment where we might feel like, oh, maybe this guy really is human. But he's so consistently monstrous that we never quite arrive at a sense of sympathy. When he's shot in cold blood at the end of the film, I think most people just go, good. We've been waiting for that this whole bloody film. And, you know, he's just killed a little girl. So, you know, how much sympathy can you really have for him? And that, too, is something that you see a lot in fairy tales. We, I think, look back on these characters and we give them motivations to humanize them. Tom Hiddleston talked about this in playing Loki in the Thor films for Marvel, the Marvel movies. And he said, you know, we've made Loki more sympathetic, and we've humanized Thor. So we trouble the hero, and we give sympathy to the villain, sympathy to the devil. And that's a very modern impulse. And it's a great impulse, because we need to be, I think, you know, when we look at the news these days, it's important for us to be humanizing people, not demonizing them. But in a cinematic tale like Pan's Labyrinth, you can have a pure villain. And Vidal definitely is one. He is more big bad wolf. He is a dragon more than he's anything else.
Ophelia, who is the hero and the princess in this story, has to defeat a few other monsters in order to complete her quest. And unlike Vidal, who presents himself really well, he's well-groomed and looks really smart in his uniform, these monsters are physically grotesque. One is a really fat, slimy toad who sucks the life force out of trees, and the other guy is this monster called the Pale Man. And the other guy is this monster called the Pale Man. And he's this bald humanoid monster with extremely saggy skin and a thirst for the blood of little children. But the cool thing is that Del Toro, the director of Pan's Labyrinth, uses these grotesque monsters to kind of reinforce Vidal's position as a monster that is just as grotesque as they are.
Every one of the monsters that Ophelia has to face in the fairy tale world is mirrored by Vidal, or vice versa. In the monstrous toad and in the Pale Man, like the room that she goes into where there's all the food on the table, it's the same set design. And the camera angles are the same, and the monster sits at the same place as Vidal's table where he hosts a dinner earlier in the film. He mirrors Vidal, saying, this is how monstrous this guy is.
Which is really cool, but I pointed out to Mike that this wasn't a detail that I would have picked up on had I not spoken to him.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think people would right away. I didn't. Like, I was studying it. I was watching it and rewatching it. But it's something I use as a way to instruct my students about the value of rewatching a good film. C.S. Lewis said that a book that wasn't worth reading twice probably wasn't worth reading the first time. I don't know that I totally agree with that, because I think there's something to be said for dumb comedies and horror films that just make you jump. But really good cinema and really good writing encourages us to stand at the end of it and give that ovation that says, encore, encore, I want to see it again. I want to experience it again. And a well-made story rewards that. We go back, we watch it again, and we go, oh, I didn't see that before. And Pan's Labyrinth is, it's a masterwork in that respect. I sometimes wonder, have I stripped it completely? You know, is there anything left to see that I haven't seen before? There were points where I would think, I probably shouldn't be teaching this anymore. It's kind of getting dated. And then I'd watch it again, and I'd go, oh, I hadn't noticed that. And it's like anything else, that somebody becomes a connoisseur of really fine wine and can taste things that nobody else can. I think if we pay attention to film and stories in different ways than just looking to them for entertainment and escapism, we can find that kind of rich detail and those layers in films like this one.
So, you know, when you watch this for the first time, there is so much complexity in the story. Visually, there's so much to take in. And that makes it sort of the opposite of a fairy tale. Fairy tales are, in a way, flat and intentionally flat. In the sense that the characters don't have an inner voice, they're not that complex. But what do you think? Do you think there is actually a lot more to unpack in the same way that Pan's Labyrinth is just full of different sort of layers?
Yeah, there's a difference, though, in that the simplicity of a fairy tale invites us to go in and fill in the blanks. I see this with my students whenever we study ancient literature. So if we're looking at something like Homer's Iliad or stories from the Bible, they start coming up with motivations for these people. They're like, well, I think the reason, you know, Achilles didn't want to fight anymore was this. And I'm like, is that in Homer's text? And they'll say, no. I'm like, then where did you get it? I'm like, you're doing creative writing now. You're coming up with your own version of this. You're imprinting you on this character. And we do that with fairy tales. We think about the simplicity of that story, and we enrich it with our own experience, because they are fairly simple stories. They're archetypal. They're very, very powerful. I don't want to say that, I don't want to make the idea that simplicity means they're stupid. Mm. They have endured for good reason. The stories are foundational, right? The girl lost in the dark wood. You can tell that story a million different ways. And if you tell it one way, it's horror, right? If the monster eats her at the end and is still out there, that's horror. If it's defeated and everybody lives happily ever after, that's fantasy. That's fairy tale. That's when you have stories like that, they endure. If they've got that adaptability. It's like with vampires. People don't like that vampires sparkled in Twilight, but it's a testament to the adaptability of the vampire as story idea that allows it to keep going on and on and on and on and on for centuries. So fairy tales endure because they have a core that can be used and reused across cultures and across time. So you get multiple versions of Cinderella, or, you know, in some cases she's called the Ash Girl. There's versions of it called Donkey Skin. All these different versions of a similar core story. And that core story can be taken and moved anywhere. So when people get all upset about Disney changing the fairy tales, I'm like, no, that actually has to happen. For the next generation to want this story, it's going to have to be used to speak to them. And we see that even between the two iterations of Disney's Beauty and the Beast. There are nuanced changes with the new Beauty and the Beast film that speak to this generation in a way that the previous one wouldn't have been ready for, and certainly not in a children's cartoon.
It almost feels like some of the changes being made to the fairy tales are too nuanced. They're not reflective enough of the sentiments that people have about gender, about the role of men and women. And I'm surprised that there hasn't been sort of a revolt against fairy tales.
I see what you mean, yeah. There has been, though. It's just not as popular. So you get people like Angela Carter, who wrote revisionist fairy tales in the 1960s. And so there's a whole tradition of that, and it's even happening in young adult fiction. Writers like Holly Black do some stuff that's very subversive, but it gets sanitized for that larger consumption, or at least watered down a little bit more than it had been previously. But those writers, like when if you look at Angela Carter's short stories, she writes about women who don't run away from the wolves; they run with the wolves. They've got this empowered sexuality. And it's an area of contention for some people. They're like, I don't know if that really counts as empowerment. But Carter was changing how people thought about fairy tales at that time. And then, you know, you get that one person who does something really innovative, like Del Toro with Pan's Labyrinth. And then a bunch of other people try to do the same thing, but they do it in a way that popularizes it. And it gets a little watered down. But I think every time we step forward a little bit, I mean, there's definitely been progress made from those fairy tales that were like, okay, girls, this is how you're supposed to act when you're, you know, getting married to a guy who's going to act like a beast.
I'm with Mike Pershon, and we're talking about Pan's Labyrinth, a dark fairy tale film that was created and directed by Guillermo del Toro back in 2006. And it's one of the few fairy tales out there that is made specifically for an adult audience, so we'll be talking more about that in just a bit. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's Happily Ever After on the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fasil, and my guest this evening is Mike Pershon. Mike teaches comparative literature at McEwen University, and he's been talking me through Pan's Labyrinth, a 2006 Spanish film that is easily one of the darkest fairy tale films that's ever been made. Del Toro, the director of the film, used all kinds of visual and spoken cues to allude to these familiar themes that we would usually find in fairy tales. So I asked Mike if there was any one particular classic fairy tale that Pan's Labyrinth was referencing or could be likened to.
No. I wish I could say yes. I obviously talk a lot about Little Red Riding Hood because it's a little girl in the woods, but the story doesn't follow that. Del Toro's drawn on so many different fairy tales for this film. There are elements of Cinderella in the character of Mercedes, who scrubs and cleans while somebody else benefits from all of her hard work. But I come back to Red Riding Hood over and over again, because even in the sense that there's woodsmen out in the woods who will come and rescue you at the last minute. I mean, they arrive too late in Ophelia's case, but they are there, and they're part of what's going on. It's like he's created, like, a mashup of so many of these recognizable motifs that almost always somebody asks, when I'm teaching it or I'm seeing it with a large group, somebody says, is this based on a book? Feels intensely literary, because he's drawing so strongly from that literary tradition.
Would you sort of classify this as a modern fairy tale?
Definitely. Especially because of that combination of realism and fantasy. People have a tough time, or at least Western audiences do. I don't know how it is elsewhere. I know that in India, obviously, with Bollywood, there's a very different aesthetic sense of, you know, what's normal for a film. And in Japan, it's not as big a deal to have that sense of hyper-realism. But in North America, if it doesn't look realistic, people usually tune out. And they'll forgive it with animation. If it's a cartoon, that's a different thing. And Del Toro really struggled with that on Pan's Labyrinth, because he wasn't as happy as he wished he would have been with the special effects. But because of the realism of the war side of the story, the, you know, Vidal's, you know, fighting the rebels in the hills, it gives the rest of the film a strong sense of reality that grounds it and gives it that depth that you were talking about earlier, where these characters have motivations that make sense to a modern viewer. So, you know, Ophelia is a fully developed, well-rounded character. She's not just this girl in a red cloak running out into the woods to go see grandma.
I mean, I know there's so much violence in the film, but is it something that, you know, that could serve well for a child to watch, just to understand the difficult choices that you're going to have to make? Like you pointed out about her deciding whether she could be this kind of person or that kind of person. But would you say that this is suitable for younger children? or would it scar the mind too much?
I'm a terrible person to ask because I watched all sorts of really scary things when I was fairly young. My dad would sneak me into drive-in movies when I was young to see movies like Conan the Barbarian. So I'm the wrong person to ask. But okay. My son is really, really sensitive. He's a sensitive guy. And he wouldn't be able to handle the violence in the film. But more than the violence, I think the death of the mother would be devastating for him. At the same time, I think that those themes are really important for people who would, I would say, you know, kids who are at the same age that Ophelia is. She's 11, she's 12 years old, she's about to become a young woman. And do I think that this would be a really valuable film for people at that age to watch? Yes. If they had somebody with them, especially, who knew the film well enough to say, okay, you know what, this next part's really, really terrible, you probably want to close your eyes for a bit. You know, knowing the child, right? I would have been fine to watch the bottle scene when I was that old, but not all kids are.
And it's not just kids who might not take to a film like Pan's Labyrinth.
One of the people who was on my committee to review my master's thesis, which was on Pan's Labyrinth, was angry with me because I had inadvertently forced her to watch this film. And she thought it was awful. It was just horrible. There wasn't anything that could possibly be redeeming about it because, boy, that bottle scene just turned her. She was outspokenly angry at me for choosing this
wow.
as my subject matter. Yeah, which I thought was bizarre because I had always thought that academics could watch anything or look at anything and have this sort of dispassion. So that was odd. But it's usually the violence. People are turned off by the violence.
But violence aside, what makes Pan's Labyrinth pretty interesting and quite different from a classic fairy tale is the fact that it keeps you guessing about whether or not the magic that you see is real. You're never really sure what's real and what's fantasy, whether or not Ophelia is imagining things or whether it's actually happening to her in real life. And for Mike, that works as sort of a litmus test for him to figure out where people are at when it comes to things like magic.
And so you get people coming, like they'll watch the film and we'll discuss it and I'll say, so what do you think? Did it happen or not? Did the fairy tale, were they just in her head? Is the fairy tale stuff just something she made up to cope? And you get this strong split between people who say it absolutely did happen and people who say it absolutely didn't. And yet the film itself doesn't really come down on one side strongly. Mm. There is one decisive thing that throws the balance in the direction of magic, but it's fascinating to see how people who have a very, very empirical worldview believe that Ophelia's made all this up, it's just a delusion, and people who want to believe or who are believers in some sense will tend towards saying, no, it really, really did happen to her.
And what do you say?
It's neither, because Del Toro's film is an anti-fascist statement, and he's so committed to not being a fascist that he won't even do it as a filmmaker. So you can make a strong argument for either side. Okay, in this instance, we question it. In this instance, we're certain it happens. In this instance, we question it back and forth and back and forth. And there's moments where the film leans towards saying, no, the magic is real. But as I say, it's not definitive. And I don't think the film is meant to be. I think in a way Del Toro is going, you know what? I gave my character the choice to say no to something. I'm going to allow you as the audience to have that same choice.
You know, I spoke to a psychoanalyst who said that he had a colleague who would use fairy tales as part of therapy, because understanding which fairy tales speak out to you or resonate with you was a sort of a shorthand to understand the person a little bit more. If I were to assume that this was your favorite fairy tale, what do you think you liking this tells you about yourself?
I like rebels. I like people who say no. I could see where it's a really interesting question, and I've never been asked it, but I immediately would have to say it's the anti-authority streak. I was always the bull in a china shop when it came to, You know, somebody would say, it has to be this way. I would go, no, let's find another way. Or if somebody said, you can't do this, I'd say, watch me. So I identify strongly with Ophelia when she doesn't shake with the right hand and when she chooses to get her dress all muddy. She doesn't follow the rules perfectly. She's not a rebel without a cause. She's not a she's not just doing this to be awful. She doesn't want to hurt her mother's feelings, but she does want to go on her quest. So she's got that idealism that focuses those things.
My thanks to Mike Pershawn for speaking to us tonight. If you've missed any part of the interview, or if you know someone who is a fan of Pan's Labyrinth, you can share this podcast, which is available on our website and mobile app. This has been Happily Ever After on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.